Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know, sometimes I hear people talk about, you know, I like the characters, but I didn't like the setting, so this is a bad book. To me, it's like if the characters are good, then it's a good book. You know, the plot, the setting, all those things, they're all important, but the characters are the fundamental thing.
So I can't believe that we made this happen, but we somehow managed to get an interview with Joe Abercrombie, author of this book right here, The Wisdom of Crowds, which I think is the end to the best epic fantasy trilogy I've ever read, The Age of Madness. Joe has been one of my favorite authors for years and years. I've probably read about 12 of his books. I would put him in my top 2. It's Joe Abercrombie and Brandon Sanderson for me. And depending on whose book I read last, that's usually the one that's at the top of my list. So being able to chat with Joe on this episode was an absolute blast. It's probably the most nervous I've been in like 100 plus episodes of recording the podcast. And we got him on for 2 episodes. So if you enjoy this one, he'll be back in next week's episode as well. So make sure to subscribe. And if you enjoy this episode, please go ahead and share it around with some other people who are into Joe Abercrombie's books. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors, and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, author of The Thunder Heist, and I'm joined by my fellow writers, starting with Michael R. Fletcher.
Hi, that's me, Michael R. Fletcher, author of Beyond Redemption and some other stuff.
Rob J. Hayes.
Hello, I'm Rob J. Hayes. I'm the author of many books. Many books.
Dirk Ashton.
I am Dirk Ashton, author of the Paternus Trilogy. Look, I have props this week.
Nice. And we are joined by a very special guest, the one and only Joe Abercrombie. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hello. It's an absolute honor for you to have me here.
Absolutely. And for the 3 people who don't know about yourself and your books, do you want to just briefly give a little spiel about yourself?
Oh, those poor, poor, sad 3 people. But no, they are lucky 3 people, for they have the joy of discovering my work, don't they? I wrote the First Law trilogy and some other books in that universe, and the Shattered Sea trilogy, and a few other bits and pieces. Edgy fantasy in it. Yeah.
A bit.
Yeah. Character-based, character-focused, and gritty, I guess.
Lots of grit.
And we love the grit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on the show. I thought the way we could kind of structure this, as we sort of mentioned off air, first episode we'll just sort of generally throw out some questions at you. We'll try to hopefully ask you stuff that you haven't been asked a million times before. And then potentially in the second episode, we can deep dive into a topic that we sort of maybe bring up in this. But it's interesting that you mentioned characters, because I wanted to ask you, how do you think you're able to so quickly establish rapport between readers and your characters? I think the moment for me where I really like sat up and started paying attention when I was reading one of your books was the chapter in The Heroes, where for 200 pages, you've been with all these other different characters. And then it's the big battle scene that
is sort of halfway through the book, where you just start in the head of a totally unknown character who you have never been in their perspective before. And in the space of 3 pages, you made me care so much about that character, only to brutally murder him, like 100 words later. And then you just like kept repeating the trick, and I couldn't understand how you're able to do it every single time. And I just wanted to know, like, how do you think you're able to so quickly establish that, like, reason to care about these characters who sometimes are just sort of, you know, throw away just there for one chapter or so?
Well, yeah, nice, I like to try. Nice, easy one. Yeah, absolutely. Let's dig into the absolute fundamental essence of what makes writing interesting or not and explain to us how that works.
Correct.
I guess I sort of feel like, you know, characters are the most important part of a book. You know, sometimes I hear people talk about, you know, I like the characters, but I didn't like the setting, so this is a bad book. To me, it's like, if the characters are good, then it's a good book. You know, the plot, the setting, all those things, they're all important, but the characters are the fundamental thing. What I respond to is the characters, the dialogue, and the kind of internal voice, the authorial voice. That's really what I'm interested in when I read a book. I want someone to talk to me in a way I've never heard before, in a way that I never could. You know, it's writing that I couldn't do myself, that I want from someone else. You know, I don't want to hear stuff that's the same as everybody else. And so when I try to write myself, I guess that's pretty much what I'm aiming for the writing to kind of pop off the page and have a voice and a clear identity right from the start, and to feel like you're being talked to by the person whose point of view you're in. You know, I read books like James Elroy's L.A. Quartet when I was younger. And in that, that's the approach he takes. You know, every character has it feels like 4 different books that are intercut if he's writing from 4 different points of view. How's it done? That's difficult to answer, because generally I like to try and take all the magical thinking out of writing as much as I can, because if you have this magical thinking about writing, that writing is some special, special, magical thing, then there'll be days when you can't do it and you have nothing to fall back on. You know, the magic either happens or it doesn't. And most of professional writing is finding ways to make progress when the magic isn't happening, I find. And so trying to take the magic out of it and treat it as mundane bricklaying is kind of sensible and healthy, I find. But having said that, there is an element of magic with characters. You never really know what's going to work and what's not until you start writing from their point of view, until you start, you know, doing conversations and really just seeing how it feels on the page. You know, you can prepare very thoroughly and have an idea of their role in the plot and their background and all those things, but until you start writing, it's hard to know whether they kind of really come alive or not. And some just work instantly for reasons I still don't really understand. And some take huge amounts of effort to get not quite as good as the ones that work with no effort. And I don't really know why that is. I wish I did. There's many kinds of tricks and things I've developed over time to try and make them work better. But I kind of don't have that answer. I mean, the specific... There is none. No, there isn't one. The specific kind of scene you were talking about, which was, you know, this idea I kind of hit upon, stole really from other people mostly. I guess it's a filmic thing perhaps more than it's a novelistic thing generally. But, you know, following one character, then you for a little while, then you quickly move on to another character and then quickly to another and so on. That kind of works well for me because I think I am, you know, reasonably good at getting a sense of a character quite quickly. When you do that and they die within a few hundred words, you don't have to pay it off, which is the difficult part. You can just kind of set them up, then kill them, and then move on to the next one and set them up. So it's kind of fun for me to just set up 10 characters in a row and never have to do anything with them. That's sort of my ideal writing situation. I suppose there's no trick, really. You kind of just try and put yourself in the shoes of that character. And you think, what are their concerns? What are their feelings? You don't worry about describing the world. You worry about how they experience the world. What are they thinking about? What makes them individual? Sometimes you use, a lot of that's instinctive, but sometimes you kind of use things like, Pharaoh in the First Law is colorblind. She never sees any colors. So nothing's described in color. It's all dark or light or black or white. And the way she sees the world is very black and white morally as well. So that all kind of suits. You know, she tends to be written in kind of paragraphs of the punchline, like longer paragraph, shorter paragraph. She kind of thinks in these staccato punchlines and so on. So there's a sort of work you can do on the rhythm of the writing, on what senses are emphasized, on what things are emphasized. If it's a kind of canny political operator, are they looking at the details of how someone, you know, behaves and talks and try to draw inferences from that and gain advantage from that, compared to someone who is self-obsessed and would never notice what someone else is doing. They're just thinking about what they'll get out of it, you know? So you're trying to just put yourself in the shoes of the character and write from their point of view, really, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I don't know. It does.
Well, sometimes it works. Well done.
Thank you.
One thing that I completely stole was how very often, not always, but very often you'll begin a chapter or a new section with a new character with either an inner thought or a line of dialogue. I found that to be extremely effective in getting a chapter going because often it's like, okay, do I say what kind of day it is and what the weather is like? Do I describe the setting? Do I describe, sometimes I'll describe what they're looking at, watching their feet plod along in the mud, and then a thought comes in. But that is an easy way for me to start. I can always go back and fix it. One of the other things I heard you saw you say early on, probably back in 2015 or something, was when you said, just vomit it on the table. You can clean it up later. And that helped. Mm.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's in the editing as well. That's another thing I perhaps should have said is that, you know, I sort of feel coming right in the first draft is the start of the, when you've got the first draft, that's when the work starts. You know, I mean, the first draft is hard, but I feel like the book comes together in the revision and, you know, you cut away what's not relevant and you emphasize what is relevant and you maybe hit upon these kind of repeated motifs that give a character some personality and speak to who they are, you know, and emphasize those things and cut other things away and just, you know, hopefully the voices become more and more defined over time. So the editing's certainly important. Definitely vomit it out, get something on the page, and then, you know, see how you can improve it later is always sensible, I think.
Rewriter.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. And I mean, you talked about starting with dialogue. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, starting with dialogue and so on. I mean, I think in terms of cutting, just never write stuff that you find boring, you know, or write it, but then cut it, you know. If the reader's bored, if you're bored, how can the reader not be bored? So,
yes,
you know, if the introduction of the room, you know, the man steps into the room and you describe the room, like, who gives a shit? Generally, the room's not that important, but you can come to that later, you know. So something that's arresting, something that speaks to character on purpose and moves the rhythm forward, you know. I worked as an editor for quite a long time, a video editor, TV and stuff, and when you kind of move, you know, when you're editing, you'll cut on action, you'll cut out of a scene and into a scene on action and movement and sound and, you know, use those things to make the jump. And so I kind of tend to still think that way. So, you know, start a scene with something sharp that gets the attention of the reader and makes some kind of point and focuses their attention on something. It's not just bland and diffuse, you know. It's not, here's a room, yeah, and there's a door and in the door's a guy. Start with something arresting, something sharp that asks a question, you know, that then the reader is taking through and lead them into a scene rather than just kind of dump it all in front of them, I suppose. Starting on dialogue. I mean, dialogue is king, really. Dialogue is the most important thing in a book. I think, you know, you can, some really great writers, Elmore Leonard's one I think of, who can kind of just do this great long exchanges without any descriptors. It's pure dialogue, totally pure dialogue. No, he said, she said, nothing. But you can tell who's speaking because the dialogue's so distinctive and so carefully kind of assembled and so full of personality that you're never in any doubt who's talking. And that's kind of the gold standard, I think, for me. Because a like good line of dialogue, you know, it advances the plot. It tells you something about the person who's speaking, about the person they're speaking to, about the relationship between them. You can achieve so much, you know, in a conversation, so much more in a conversation than you can kind of just laying it out in a dull way. And, you know, hopefully it can be funny and sharp and profound and all those things, you know. So, yeah, great dialogue is essential for me anyway.
Would you say that's the main way you try to keep the writing process enjoyable for yourself? Because, like, having written, how many novels have you published now? It would be like 14, 13 or so?
I'm writing my 14th now, yeah.
14th. Nice. That's awesome.
If you count the short stories, so it's 30 novels, yeah.
So, like, I guess one of the things I'm very interested in is, like, how do you keep the process enjoyable as you get, like, further into the career? And there's a few things you've talked about that, like, are interesting to me, because you say, you know, you try to view writing as just, you know, manual labor, just putting blocks down, which I agree with. I think that's a great way of looking at it rather than thinking it's this mystical magic thing. And then you've also said you try to make sure that you're not writing stuff that bores yourself. So how do you, you know, how do you try to keep it interesting and how do you enjoy the process while you're, you know, working on your 14th book?
With some difficulty, if I'm honest.
Sure.
I think certainly they kind of say everyone has one book in them, and that may be true, but one book's not a career, at least not for most writers. So, you know, with fantasy writers, probably we have one series in us, one trilogy, whatever it may be. You know, I wanted to write my version of Lord of the Rings, basically. And then I did that, and that was a lot of fun.
What's next?
A hobby. Yeah, exactly. It was a hobby that, you know, I was doing while I was doing other things, in a way. And so it was fun. It was what I did at night for amusement. And then you write it and maybe you publish it and suddenly you've got to write something else. And, you know, that's a bit of a shocking moment because, you know, at least for me, when I was writing my first trilogy, I got better and better at it. I got faster and faster. I got very fast towards the end of it. I was writing 2,000 or 3,000 words a day. I was just smashing it out. And they were good as well because I'd kind of had all the voices there, the characters were there, everything was set up to be knocked down, easy peasy, right? And I thought, I'm brilliant at this now. I'll write 3,000 words a day for the rest of my life. I'll be writing 6 books a year. And then, of course, I got to my 4th book and suddenly I just didn't know what I was doing at all.
Every time.
New characters, new settings. And also, you know, I think you kind of, with your first book, your first series, you kind of use up a lot of inspiration and ideas and ways of looking at the world that you have developed during your life. The stuff that's in easy reach, the types of characters that feel natural, the situations, the themes, you know, you use them. And so you don't have that well to draw on when you come to write something else. It's suddenly the well runs dry and you're a bit like, what am I going to do now?
So I think deeper.
Yeah, you have to reach further, but I think also, you know, a certain degree craft kind of comes to compensate for that slight loss of inspiration. We're probably, I think, as writers, often you're best known for your first book, and that remains the case because, you know, that's how people first encounter your voice. That's when it's at its most kind of luminous and exciting. And you spend your whole career sort of trying to recapture that a lot of the time, which is a bit sad to say, perhaps. not that you don't write other good stuff, not that no one ever writes amazing books later in a career and so on, but there's a certain kind of exuberance and freedom often about a first book that is hard to recapture as you are published and read and it becomes a profession and you second guess yourself a lot more. And you're subjected to scrutiny. And, you know, that is kind of is tough. When it becomes your main work, it is work in the end as well, you know, and with all the pressures that entails. And so sometimes it's not easy to make progress, you know. I find for myself that every book is kind of hard work and I always slightly forget how hard work the last book was. I find the first draft is grueling. You know, the start is usually good. Because, you know, it's exciting and new and you're like, whoa, new characters, new stuff. Yeah. You know, and then you get through the start and suddenly it becomes a slog and you're kind of staring at the word count all day. Mm. Another 100 words, and I can I can play video games. I can play Elden Ring.
On Twitter for 5 minutes.
I've got 600 words out. Exactly.
And then it turns into 50. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's important to kind of try and maintain a bit of a workmanlike attitude to it. But some days are tough and you've got to not beat yourself up too much. You just got to say, well, you know, you have a bad days, you have good days. You try and make a steady, reasonable progress. Then once I've got to the end of a first draft, usually that's the moment I say, ah, this is not as bad as I thought it was. There's probably a book in here. If I can just pare the nonsense away. And so then you start working through, discuss it with editors and other people, you know, who have sage advice to give and new viewpoints to take on it. And then, you know, come up with a plan of paring it away and making it work a bit better, you know, making the plot work better, making the arcs of the characters make sense, you know, deciding who they need to be. And then bodge it around a bit and reshape it. And before you know it, you've got a kind of pretty decent second draft, and then you can refine that, and then it gets more and more fun, I find, as you're refining and improving.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
That second draft is hard work and really important work. But isn't the most fun for me, because that's when you go from I've got a load of junk that might be something to I've got a book that I like, hopefully. And then you can refine it further and further in other ways. But yes, that's sort of my process. Panic.
Have you ever written one?
Sort it out in 3 months.
Have you ever written a book that you've got to sort of the end, and rather than that sort of thing where you're like, ah, there is a book in here somewhere, have you ever got to the point where you're just like, you're reading through it after you've written it and gone, nah, this is just trash? Because we had Brian Staveley
on. Have you read my books? I'm fucking dead.
we had Brian Staveley on a while back, and he was telling us that he'd written a book, and it got to the point where he was submitted it to I think it was his editor, and his agent just came back to him and went, you can't submit this, it's not good. And I mean, I know I've been through a similar thing where I've written a book before and I knew it was trash. I sent it to my alpha readers and they came back and just went, no, it's terrible. So just wondering if you've ever had a sort of similar situation.
Not quite like that. I mean, not reach that point of having a finished book and thinking, oh God, this is crap. I mean, I've certainly felt in the midst of a draft, this is bad. This is going to be a disaster. And I think Best of Cold for me particularly, because that was sort of my difficult second album in a way. You know, I'd written a trilogy, same characters, same story. And so that was really one big book. And then starting a new thing, you know, really felt directionless and not sure what the hell I was doing. And again, first part I was kind of fine, and then I started to meander a bit, and then I really found it started to get longer than I was than I'd ever planned it as well, which didn't help. Felt like I was losing control of it. Felt like it was going to be terrible, and you know, would be career-ending disaster really, because I'd never had that experience before. You know, I'd started writing the first law for fun. I'd written a book just sitting around to entertain myself, not cared really whether it was good or bad particularly. It was just an experiment, a laugh, you know. And so with this, it was a very different set of circumstances. You know, there was some expectation, had a new deal to service, publisher to keep happy. And I'd not had that experience of just thinking, this is really bad, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know. I hadn't realised that every book feels like that. Up to a point. Some are better than others, you know. Some are certainly better than others. But, you know, knowing that in a way helps, because you think, God, this is terrible, this is really bad. But I thought that last time and it turned out okay. So maybe this will turn out okay. And the more you do it, the more things seem to turn out okay. And so you kind of accept that it can be a grind. But I think generally, by the time I've finished a first draft, I've always felt, okay, I see what I've got to do now. Not so much, this is brilliant, I was wrong, I am a genius, not that, but kind of, okay, I get it. I see what works, I see what doesn't. And often I find that, you know, I kind of converge on a point of what the book is. So the early parts, you know, I write it one part at a time and usually discuss it with my editor one part at a time as well. The first couple of parts are usually quite a mess, and sometimes the characters aren't really quite what they become by the end. But by the last part, I've kind of understood what I'm doing. I've discussed each part as I've gone along with my editor. I've sort of said, maybe this is working, maybe this isn't. She's given some ideas, said what she likes, what she doesn't like. And I kind of take all that on as I go. And so by the time I get to that last part, usually I kind of pretty good idea what I'm doing. So the last part's pretty close to what I want. And then it's really going back and rewriting the early parts of it. So there's always a lot of work to do, but I've never felt like it was unsalvageable. No. Not so far. Of course, there's still time. Because I have a hugely long and successful career ahead of me.
It makes you feel any better. Best of Cold is still my favourite of your novels.
Well, thank you.
There we go.
What's wrong with the other ones? I'm joking. I mean, thanks. One thing that I kind of take some pride in is that no one, generally people don't much agree on what is my best book and what isn't, because I try to do something a bit different each time. It's that difficult thing of split, you know, threading the needle between giving people what they want and expect and giving something new. Because, you know, the little people, they don't know what they want. They need us to tell them. They need us to tell them what they want.
The Age of Madness, I can totally agree with that statement.
They always say they want the same thing as last time, but what they mean is they want something indefinably different from last time and yet somehow kind of similar. And so you've got to try and do different stuff each time. And luckily, that does mean inevitably some people will like, you know, your old books more than your new, but hopefully some will like your new books more than your old. So I'm kind of proud of the fact that there's a pretty even spread across my books of people who like one thing or another.
From what I've seen, yeah.
I even find it hard. I think this speaks to the quality of your characterization in the books in general. Is like, as I was reading through The Age of Madness, in each book, I had a different character who I was like, yes, this is definitely going to be the best character in the series. And then the next book, it changes. And every time I was like, no, this character is definitely the best. And looking back on it now, I'm like, yeah, I just can't pick one. Like, they all do very different things while still like having that, I don't know, essential complexity and compellingness to them that makes them exciting. And yeah, I guess that's sort of what, you know, you're aiming to try to do with your books in general, right? Is like, you want to have enough of the same stuff between them that people who like one book are going to continue to the others and read and enjoy them. But ideally, each of them is playing like a different game so that it's not so much a competition. It's more just like, you know, one book is running the 100-meter sprint and another one is doing the javelin throw and another one is doing high jump. So they're all entertaining for like different reasons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad you've kind of different characters have landed. I mean, I think as well, you're probably trying in the course of a series to kind of have an ebb and flow where, you know, some characters move to the fore at some points and others are more involved in the story at others, while, you know, some fade back and forth, and there's kind of, you know, someone have the climax of a plot line at one point, you know, while others aren't really involved, and then others will kind of step in later. And that's something I've kind of learned to do better over time, to kind of plan and shape it so there's, you know, the right tension, the right sense of things building up and calming down and building up again as you go. But it's good that characters should kind of, you know, change and surprise you a little bit, and you know, ones that you weren't sure about should do things you like, and ones that you thought you liked should disappoint and upset you. Disappointing and upsetting the reader is really my bag.
Every tear they drop onto the book extends your life by another month, I've heard. So the rumor goes. I was going to ask, actually, on the note of kind of it being more fun in a sense to write the books when you had a day job, did you find that like holding on to the freelance book editing, the freelance video editing for a while into your career was beneficial for that? Because at what point did you totally stop doing that? It wasn't like after the first book, right? It was a couple of books in.
No, not at all. I mean, enormously beneficial. I was kind of really lucky. If I hadn't done that job, I might never have started writing in a way, because the nature of that work is that you'll do, you know, I was working on documentaries mostly and some kind of live music stuff and things. So you might have a 6-week job on a documentary, and then, you know, you might have 2 or 3 weeks off, and then a couple of weeks on a concert, straight into another 6 weeks on a documentary, then a week or two off. Nothing ever sits exactly together. So you end up with quite a lot of time off. Even in a busy year, you might work 40 weeks. And so you've got a lot of weeks where you're not really doing anything often. And, you know, I spent about 3 or 4 years playing computer games solidly in that nice time. Total War and so on. A lot of time spent playing that. And then I felt like, oh man, I really need a project that's going to, you know, be of value. And because being an editor, you know, leaves you at the mercy of directors a lot. It's a great job, but it's not really, you're not the originator. You're not the kind of, you don't make the final call on stuff. I felt like it would be nice to do something that I kind of control creatively. So I thought, oh, I'll pick up that shit book that I wrote when I was 20 and have another go. And that's kind of why I started, you know. And so I wrote in weeks off, I wrote in evenings and so on, and got really into it and wrote actually quite fast after a certain time. But then once I did get a deal, which took a while, it wasn't like a life-changing amount of money. There was no possibility of becoming a full-time writer on the advance I was getting, for even though I'd got like 2 books already written. But it meant I could take it more seriously, you know, and commit a more time to it. And kind of, I was very lucky. I didn't have to storm out of the office and say, I'm bigger than you now. Fuck you, insurance. I'm no longer going to do this job.
Just piss I'm on a the writer. Pot plants, you know.
Exactly.
Throw some desks.
Throw some desks around. I could just take a few less jobs, fewer jobs, do the jobs I wanted. And so I kind of just worked 30 weeks a year, or then scaled it gradually back, worked for fewer and fewer clients. And I was really lucky from that point of view. So about 5 years probably from getting a deal to more or less giving up the editing. And then I moved out of London, which kind of made the call for me in a way, because I was too far away from where a lot of the work was happening to really do the work then. So by that point, I was basically a full-time writer. It took a long time. And as you say, the weird thing is that I didn't necessarily increase my speed of writing. In fact, if anything, I got slower.
Sure.
When I first became full-time, because it was a totally new experience. And I still find, actually, I'm more productive when I've got other nonsense going on than when I have all the day just to sit there. I kind of constantly moan and complain, leave me alone, I need this day to focus on my art. But in fact, I'm better working in the time in between other stuff. weirdly.
It's the different methods of working. So like, I know some people who work best in like bursts. They'll do sort of half an hour and then they'll go and do something else for a half hour. Whereas,
yeah,
I find that if I'm just sat there for the entire day, quite often I'll be like, I'll load up some social media. And it's kind of like, I think your brain needs a break, but you're not willing to give it one, whereas you really should. I think it can definitely work better if you just sort of do it in bursts.
Yeah, I mean, I just find there's times when I'm really into a book, which are glorious. Often it's a series, like, you know, say The Age of Madness recently, the first book took longer than the other two combined. So, you know, the first book took quite a long time to do and was slow and difficult. But by the time I got to the second one, I wrote The Trouble with Peace and The Wisdom of Crowds in a little bit over a year, both together, which is insanely fast for me.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was like, 10,000-15,000 words a week, which is
so good.
Ludicrously fast.
Yeah.
I'm down to about 5,000 at the moment, if that.
Oh, that's so very reassuring to hear. Because that's where I'm at the moment.
it wildly changes depending on the project and what else is going on and just who knows why.
Awesome. Well, I think we'll probably put a pause there and continue with part two in next week's episode. So, Joe, thanks for coming on for this part one. This has been an absolute blast. And
thank you.
Yeah, we'll see all of you or next week on the audio or video feeds. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening or watching to this episode of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you like what we're doing here and you would like to help support the show, please go to patreon.com/wizards, warriors, and words. And for a monthly subscription, you can get access to bonus episodes that you can't find anywhere else. Currently, we have 5 bonus episodes up there, and we're going to be adding more in the future. So you can check that out. The link is down below if you would like to have a look. And special thanks to our high-tier patrons, Talon, Daniel, and Lewis. Thank you for helping support the show. We'll see you next week.